Okay. So welcome to the inquiry session. You will notice that there's a spare cushion here. That's for one of you. And you're invited to come with a question. A question perhaps about the Dharma, or a question that's arisen from your practice. Or it may be a question more generally from your life, something that you've been reflecting on. Please don't make it a theoretical question, a problem that your neighbor has or someone down the street, but please make it rather relevant. Sometimes we say, please come with a burning question, a question that really requires some inquiry and some reflection. So there will be a dialogue, and those of you who are listening are very much part of it. So please listen inwardly to your own responses. Sometimes those responses are quite obvious, and sometimes they're rather more subtle. It may be that the person is asking the question that you wish you had asked. And so then you will be listening with attention. Listen also for any kinds of judgments that may arise. It may be that you think it's going on for too long, or that Radha should say this now, or that it's too psychological perhaps, or too intellectual, or too slow, or too fast, and so on. There can be all kinds of responses and reactions. Your attention is really required for the deep inquiry process. So I invite you to really listen respectfully, with kindness and with attention. If you find your mind wandering off, please bring the focus back again. When there's a room full of people, listening attentively, it really adds to the depth of the inquiry. So we are all included, not just the two at the front. At any time you may say thank you and leave, and at any time I may say thank you and you also leave. Or I could leave. I don't have any space on my phone at the moment, so I won't be recording it today. It's being recorded here? Okay. If you don't wish, what's happening? If you don't wish for it to be recorded, then perhaps let us know at the end. In between each inquiry, there'll be some silence. Okay? Let's just sit for a moment and then I'll ring the bell and make an invitation. If you're having difficulty hearing at the back, even with the microphone, there's lots of space at the front here. So please come forward. There's even empty cushions. Yes, anybody? Yes, please come. And if you would just say your name at the beginning, please.
My name is Sapir. And I would like to start by sharing. A year and a half ago, I had a non-dual experience of anatta, which now I can say was way too soon in my practice. And every time I come to a retreat, I see a different kind of attachment to that experience that I'm unable to let go of. At the beginning, it was the freedom it gave me, and now I feel more trapped inside the longing for the experience, or the... I feel that a lot of what I have left of the experience is the things I've told myself about it afterward. So I sometimes now have experiences of just looking around me and feeling that I'm living in something that is not true. And it's hard for me to cope with it on a daily basis.
Can you tell me or describe the experience?
Well, I was in a place of discomfort.
Yes.
Physically, yes. And in the environment. And I decided to not fight it, but to meditate on it. And I really don't have the experience with me anymore, but I remember feeling that my head just blew up and detached from my body, and there was no me, there was nothing. And because there was nothing, there was everything. So
yes, beautiful. Okay. So, of course, this particular experience has a beginning and an ending. But the key thing is the wisdom, the understanding from the experience. And reflecting on our experiences is really an important thing to do. After the Buddha had his single excellent night under the Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya, he spent 7 whole weeks reflecting on his experience. So reflecting now on that experience until you understand it really fully is totally and utterly important. So let's begin. You've obviously been doing some already. Mm-hmm. So my head blew apart. So all concepts ceased, including any kind of notion of you. Mm-hmm. What does that tell you? What does the stilling of all thought, all concepts, and the ending of any notion of identity say to you?
I know what it said to me.
Yes. It said what?
That there was no self.
Yes. That, hang on. Not that there was no self, but that thoughts, feelings, any idea I have of myself is not necessarily so.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
Okay.
Also, I felt like I'm connected to everything.
Yes. Yes.
And I still feel that, but sometimes it makes me feel like I'm crazy.
Okay. So this is where there is still perhaps a touch of clinging. Say a little more about the connection to everything. It's a beautiful, beautiful experience. Mm-hmm. mm-hmm. feeling connected to all things everywhere. And many of us in this room would have had a similar experience.
Well, I felt there was no separation between me and, well, the people around me, and the air between us was not.
Yeah. And so what does that tell you about how to live your life?
With love.
Yes. Yeah, with love, completely. Mm-hmm. What does it tell you about love?
That it's whole.
Yes. Yes. What else?
That I don't need to press it.
Yes.
That it is. It is.
Yes. It is. So when all notion of the separate sense of self ceases, when all concepts, ideas, thoughts, views, and opinions, even for a moment, just stop, what's revealed is the extraordinary beauty of love and truth. Where we see we are no thing, you said nothing, but we see we are no thing, yet everything. We're connected to everything. He said that when you feel as if you're connected to everything, you feel like you're going crazy. Can you say a little more?
Well, I feel a lot more connected to plants.
Yes.
And, I don't know, just being around a tree and asking him a question, I feel him answering, mm-hmm. and I don't know, I feel energy from things.
Yes.
Not so much from objects, but from trees and plants and...
Okay, so from living things, you feel a sense of life, of connection.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful. Why not? What would happen if someone came and cut the tree down?
It hurts me.
Yes, okay. Okay. So, sometimes when we have these profound experiences, they go rather deeply. And sometimes there's still a kind of trace of identity that remains.
Mm-hmm.
And the sense of I, as in you, the woman, can cease, and yet the sense of I can then be projected onto all things. And so then, of course, when something happens in the environment, when there's, you know, the huge kind of logging of forests that happens in Australia, or the degradation of the environment, people feel it as if it is their own suffering, and it's incredibly painful. So this would indicate that there's still some clinging. Just, there's a trace of identity. I've said enough. What's your response?
I would like to continue the... It doesn't stop with trees.
Yes.
I actually noticed lately specifically that I feel guilty a lot
mm-hmm.
for other people's actions.
Yes, yes.
While also being hurt for what they did. So mm-hmm. I feel like I'm experiencing both sides of a scenario that that Sapir wasn't a part of.
Mm. Yes. So the sense of I has landed on the larger consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some clinging because there's pain. Do you think that when someone else does something to hurt another, that it's your fault?
I feel responsible.
Yes. Yes. Do you think that's really clear, seeing?
Clear what?
Seeing. I feel responsible. when someone else harms another.
Yes.
You do?
Yeah, because it's an extension of me in some way.
Mm-hmm. So the me, instead of being just the body and the thoughts and the feelings, has now extended to include all things. This is also dangerous territory because it's also identification. It's just an expanded identification. The I is clinging to the larger consciousness. Okay. Let's leave that there for a moment. Mm-hmm. Come to the love that you felt. Right now. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see. Does this love have any limit?
No.
No. So it includes everything and everybody.
Even flies and ants.
Yes. Does it also include the trace of the eye that clings to something?
Not enough.
Okay. The limitless, this boundless love, must include the totality. And when this sinks really deeply into our being and is known fully, all clinging ends. Even the trace of clinging to consciousness.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for describing so clearly and well your journey. Be totally in love. Thank you. Yes, anybody?
Hello.
Hello.
My name is Rami. And I have a question regarding relationship with my kids.
Yes.
So I have two kids, two beautiful kids.
How old?
4 and 6 years old. My son is 4 and my daughter is 6 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And another one on the way.
Ah.
My daughter I mean, her character or the way she behaves sometimes, she seems similar to, she's very, she has a temper.
Yes.
And it reminds me of myself when I was younger.
Yes.
Or less trained, maybe. And I don't really know how to help her. Because her way of communicating her wants and needs is always by nagging, and not always, but a lot of times. And I think it's especially at home. But I think with all the family, also with her grandma and her mother and myself, by being just nagging and screaming and being acting like this, and it hurts me to see it, first of all, and I want to help her, to teach her to express her will and communicate in a, and not to feel bad so much about wanting and longing for things, but on the other hand, she's a 6-year-old, so I don't know how to react to this kind of.
So what do you remember about yourself at this age? You said you were a little similar when you were younger.
Not necessarily younger, but...
So more recently.
More recently. I mean, I went through quite a big transformation.
Yes?
Yes.
So what was it that helped you?
I had this, I don't know what's the word to find it, but I had this, not, I don't want to use a big term, like awakening, but I had a clarity.
Yes.
About what's, important.
Yes.
Which is for me, it was a year ago, a year and a half ago, and suddenly I understood, after a certain experience, that what's important in life is being present and interacting with love and giving to everything that I can, and it became like suddenly I had a compass.
Yes.
What's guiding me, and it transformed everything for me.
So when you interacted with love, the anger ceased.
Yes.
Okay, could this be a clue? So now when you see your daughter is acting perhaps impatiently or angrily or is demanding of attention, she wants what she wants, when she wants it, and so on. Within you, is there a reaction of love or something else?
Sometimes there is,
yes.
And sometimes there isn't. No, I don't get angry.
Good.
I try to. Anyway.
Good. Very good.
Which is a big difference from what I was in the past. But,
yes.
But sometimes I feel that I don't know how to help her get out of it, except for being there. Being positive, being loving, and
okay. Has there been a single occasion when you've been loving and she has stopped being or changed her behavior from nagging, irritating, demanding to something else?
Well, I think after a while she sees that, because when she acts like this, she wants something, and not necessarily she can always have what she wants.
Yes. So, have you spoken to her about this?
I try to.
Yeah? And what does she say? You say, you can't always have what you want.
Sometimes when I try to speak to her, she doesn't want to listen.
Of course not. Did you want to listen to your parents when you were young?
Not
and in the midst of anger? No.
No, but even afterwards.
Yes. Okay. So, how can you show your daughter so much love that she feels and knows the love for herself.
Maybe spend more time with her.
Yes.
For example, on a one-on-one basis, because
yes,
that makes a big difference.
So spending time when she's not in the midst of some kind of volatile expression, emotional expression, spending time with her, more time. Okay, what else? How could you show her love, that you really, really care?
Not judging her when she's angry.
Yes. So know for yourself that love that is not dependent upon conditions. Because we often say, even in a subtle way, we love someone more when they're loving back. When they're angry, it's hard to have that kind of steadiness of love. But as parents, this is our job. It's what we need to do. So to be totally loving. What else?
I think I already labeled her in a way.
Yes. Yes. When one of my sons was about 6 years old, in fact, he is a twin. And he started to be a little bit, we say in English, obnoxious. He started to be demanding and hard to be around, and bossy, and he was pushing his other twin around and so on, doing all kinds of things that I found really hard to see. As a mother, I thought, what's happened to my beautiful baby that suddenly he's behaving like this? And then I had a moment of kind of inspiration. And so instead of telling him not to do things over and over again, which seemed to be making the behavior more entrenched, what I did was I decided that every day I would spend some time massaging him. Just, you know, he'd sit on my lap and I'd massage his back. And I would do it when there was no problem, when he wasn't asking for anything. I just made sure that I spent every day just at least 10 minutes with him, really taking care, really doing something kind. And you know what? His whole behavior changed. The irritating behavior, the behavior I found irritating, just fell away by itself. So sometimes you have to come up with a strategy that's not born of reactivity on your part, but comes from somewhere else within you. Okay, this is the skill of parenting. So deeply within you, you've already said, I want to spend more time with my daughter. I want to show her love. I want to let go of the judgmentality and the reactivity. Fabulous. So in practical terms, what can you do? One more thing.
It's like a quiz, but...
Yeah. So deeply from within you. I don't know the answer, but you will.
I think it's more of like kind of a nourishment of our relationship.
Yes.
And not... I think she... what I understand is that the reason that she acts like this is maybe because she's missing some love.
Mm.
And maybe her little brother got too much attention and she's expected to be the grown up. And
yes, and she's only 6. Yeah. So the task for you is to rest in a love that is not dependent upon her reactivity, not in reaction to her behavior. But to rest in a very wise place. So there's the love that needs to be expressed by spending time, by being loving. But what else as parents are we asked to do?
I think to, like, when we sit in meditation and we go through different kind of feelings, then we're not reacting or attaching to it, to be there, to absorb.
And also to, we are a guide for our children. So to really make that guidance come from a depth of wisdom within ourselves. And from your own experience, you know this emotional territory. And you know the way through. So you can teach your daughter. And you can teach her very well.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, anybody.
Hello, my name is Sharon. A little over a month ago, I came back from to Israel after a year's residency at a monastery.
And where was the monastery?
Upstate New York.
Okay.
So it's a Zen monastery. And during my time at the monastery, I realized how much I was avoiding suffering while, you know, before I came to the monastery, you know, how I did everything to distract myself from that suffering, you know, drowned myself in work and smoked marijuana and did absolutely nothing other than that, you know. Didn't socialize, you know, as I used to. I just sort of hid at home and did not want to deal with anything other than work, of course. And during the time in the monastery, it felt as if I started living again.
Mm. Beautiful.
It really felt like this. You know, and I spent a whole year there. That's quite a long time. And then the year ended and I came back about a month ago. And I still practice, you know, on a daily basis. That's sort of my anchor. But honestly, all I want to do is hide at home, smoke, and it's like everything that I learned I can't hold on to it. I mean, I know it. I know how I felt. But it's... I don't know. It's hard for me to explain. I don't understand where all this is coming from.
Okay.
And why I don't have the wish, or I don't know if saying the wish is the right thing, but it's like I don't want to deal with things anymore. Mm. I think that's the thing.
Mm. So you see already that your smoking and staying at home, the isolation, is not dealing with life itself. Instead, it's obliterating or attempting to obliterate the feeling and emotional world until the point where you feel as if you're not living. What made you go to the monastery? What was the reason for going from that kind of life to the monastery?
Because I didn't want to live the rest of my life the way I did.
Okay. Mm. Is that still the case?
It is.
Mm.
I have to say that I'm going back to the monastery.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So, in a way, you know, I have like 3 months in Israel, so this is sort of my time off.
Okay.
You know, maybe I should have, you know, that's the way I look at it. So, you know, I don't push myself as hard. But it's this thing that I have inside. It's big, you know, me not wanting to deal, me wanting to run away. And I was very surprised at how quickly and so easily I went back to that place.
Yes. So these are the tendencies of the heart and mind that still have power over you. Sometimes we have some experiences in a monastery, for example, in a meditation retreat, or when we're traveling away from our ordinary environment, where we feel very alive. We feel that our habitual behavior from the past is no longer required because there is another way of living that we've embraced. So please tell me about this. When you felt alive, what were you doing?
Nothing that I did before.
That's right.
I think I was just, you know, very aware of being in a place of practice and being, trying to be very much in the moment. And also, I think the Sangha, the community, was also a very big part of it. We had very open, honest, loving, supporting interactions with each other. So that was unbelievable, and that was very helpful and for my personal happiness. Okay. And my feeling of connection.
So sitting practice, open communication, the friendship and warmth and connection with the Sangha. Is there not a Sangha here?
There is.
Yes.
And I actually have a Sangha in Tel Aviv.
Yes.
You know, but.
But? But. What's happening?
I rather stay home and see Games of Thrones. You know?
Would you? Or is this a self-sabotaging kind of mechanism?
It is.
Mm. Mm. Addictive behaviors like smoking marijuana or doing something we know will harm us can be rather entrenched. And we usually sit in some kind of belief system we have about ourselves. Have you explored this? How do you feel about yourself?
Oh, I hate that. You know that almost, you know, most of the people around me, even people who are very, very close to me, don't really know that I smoke.
Okay.
Because I'm not a smoking person. Mm. You know, I'm not that person.
You're the spiritual person who hangs out in monasteries.
Yeah, you know, I'm not that person. So even before the monastery, you know, I was not that person. I was that, you know, different person.
So it's a secret.
Yeah.
Until now.
Don't tell.
Too late.
Oh, well.
In the world of addictions, I've worked as a psychologist with people with addictions for the last 20 years. There's a saying which I think is rather true, we're only as sick as our secrets. So sometimes when we keep part of ourselves rather hidden and don't look at it and don't want to address it, we keep on harming ourselves and hurting ourselves. And we feel powerless in the face of it, powerless to change it. But it's not true. You can. So, when do you leave to go back to the monastery?
In about 2 months.
Mm-hmm. Can you see the duality that you have of there's the life, the spiritual life in the monastery? And then there's life in the world. And that the two don't match.
It doesn't have to be this way. I mean, they do match, you know. It's not that, it's not, it shouldn't be that different. It's just that.
Okay, well seen. So what would have to change?
Nothing.
Nothing.
I should. What I was gonna say, you know, I should keep living the way I lived in the monastery, but that's the thing. You know, it's like I came out of that very structured.
Mm-hmm.
Schedule with my teacher living with me, with, you know,
yes.
Doka-san, with,
yes.
You know, with very serious practitioners and, yes. You know, with, and it's just, I don't have that, motivation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it also, yeah.
So you don't want to go on punishing yourself. What's the inner belief that's holding all of this in place? There will be one. I promise you.
I guess it all has to do with, you know, my low self-esteem.
Mm-hmm. Say a little more.
I don't really know much more than that.
Okay. Do you like yourself?
Sometimes.
And the other time?
I don't like myself when, you know, these are the things that I do.
Yes. Yes.
I'm okay with myself when, you know, I don't do those things.
So I'm okay with the spiritual self, but I'm not okay with the one who parties. One who stays home and obliterates the feeling world. What if you really had the courage to turn totally towards your suffering? The first noble truth is really to comprehend our suffering, to really, really, fully be with it. What would it take for you to do that?
To be with my suffering?
Yes.
Stop avoiding it?
Yes. Okay. So right now, why wait? So right now, please be with it.
I feel it in my body.
Where in your body?
Mainly my chest. Okay. A little, my abdominal.
Okay, so please be with that right now. Tenderly, kindly, lovingly. Being with that suffering as you would the suffering of another. So when you're really with the suffering, what occurs?
It feels as if something opens up a little bit.
Yes. Beautiful. So let it open up even more. Really face it, really be with it.
Thank you.
I'll just offer a short reflection. Sometimes we can have experiences where the conventional sense of self dissolves almost completely. All concepts, all thoughts cease. In fact, it can dissolve completely. All notion of I and me ceases. Even just for a short time. Even just for 30 seconds. Or 1 minute. This can happen when we're watching the sunset. It can happen when we see a beautiful flower. It can happen when we look into the eyes of a child or our lover. All sense of self, the me, falls away. And that reveals the extraordinary love, the great vastness, which is limitless. The capacity we have as human beings to really love. And in that experience, of course, we tend to feel connected to all things, to all beings. Sometimes the I rests in the experience and says, I am consciousness, I am this expanded consciousness. As if the small I with all of its troubles isn't trouble enough. We then expand the consciousness. So we have to be really, really astute, awake, alert. Alert for any clinging in the world of I. The I, of course, will long for the beautiful spiritual experience over again. We will want it back. This is very natural when it happens. We have some kind of shift. We have some kind of moment that's wonderful. And then, of course, what we want is for it back. What we really need is to understand the experience, to see into the experience, to draw out the wisdom so that we know how to live. The experience ends, but the wisdom doesn't. And as Dharma practitioners, this is so important for us to see that, yes, fabulous experiences in and of themselves arise and cease, but the profound understanding, wisdom, and knowing can stay. After the Buddha sat under the Bodhi tree, he said, light arose, wisdom arose, knowing arose, understanding arose. And he reflected on it for many days to see into the experience. So we need to do the same. And then we see the value of the experience in this very life. And the same, of course, when we relate to our children or the children of others if we don't have any of our own. It's important to see with wisdom. I call it non-dual wisdom, the kind of wisdom that springs from that place within us when we let go of being the one who is the father who is reactive or the mother who is reactive. When we let go of our own reactivity based on our own conditioning and see with wisdom, we can come up with some fantastic ways of relating, some creative ways of relating to a child who is suffering, a child who is in pain. We also need to remember that we were young once, and so we have empathy for the person, incredible empathy. Empathy is such a precious thing. And when we show empathy to someone who's angry, generally the anger subsides. So empathy is a key. And finally, with a mind that tends to be addictive, tends to reach for something to pacify the feeling world or obliterate the feeling world of the emotional world. We need to see, as you did, that this isn't wise, and there's another way of being. And in the Dharma world, we're really invited to be with our suffering, to comprehend it, to understand it, to be so near it that the very suffering itself is a doorway to liberation. And that act of turning towards the suffering with kindness, tenderness, compassion, in itself, yes, brings release. Brings release. Because we can run from our suffering to a cave, to a monastery. Or we can hide at home with it. But wherever we go, it will follow. So it requires a shift. So not reacting bound to the conditioned mind, the tendencies, the sankharas, but a fresh way of being, a fresh response. This fresh response is born of love, born of kindness. So thank you all three for inquiring, and thank you very much, each of you, for your attention, for listening, and for listening so beautifully and quietly and attentively. It's precious. And as we explore together from that, enormous changes can come. Don't underestimate the power of inquiry to bring about powerful changes for the liberation of one and all. So thank you for listening. So please live with love, sensitivity, tenderness, and the spirit of inquiry. Thank you.